Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1356. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 30. This is being recorded on October 26th of the year 2024. And before I bring back to our airwaves my brilliant new co-host Monty, I want to emphatically encourage listeners to this program to get a hold of the 64-gigabyte flash drive containing all of my life's work, both printed and recorded, and I'm in my 46th year on the air, plus a mini library of old anti-fascist books. And when I make reference to AFA Program 23 or 32 recorded decades ago, that's all on there. When I talk about Leon Jaworski, that's all on there. And all of our conversations with Monty, and this will be number 30, that will be on there, as well as my work on the origins of COVID, that will be on there as well. The brilliant contributions of our contributing editor, Tara Fractor, will be on there. So please get a hold of that. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves my new co-host, Monty. Monty, welcome back.
Thank you, Dave. Happy to be here.
And we've been reading from an article. I'm going to reread parts of this. Another Substack article, Letters from an American by Heather Cox Richardson from October 21st of 2024. Then I'll hand the ball off to you. On Saturday, September 7th, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump predicted that his plan to deport 15 to 20 million people currently living in the U.S. would be, quote, bloody, unquote. He also promised to prosecute his political opponents, including, he wrote, lawyers, political operatives, donors, illegal voters, and election officials. Retired chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, told journalist Bob Woodward that Trump is, quote, a fascist to the core, the most dangerous person to this country, unquote. On October 14th, Trump told Fox News Channel host Maria Bartiromo that he thought enemies within the U.S. were more dangerous than foreign adversaries, and that he thought the military should stop those, quote, radical left lunatics, unquote, on Election Day. Since then, he has been talking a lot about, quote, the enemy from within, unquote, specifically naming Representative Adam Schiff and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, both Democrats from California, as, quote, bad people, unquote. Schiff was the chair of the House Intelligence Committee that broke the 2019 story of Trump's attempt to extort Volodymyr Zelensky that led to Trump's first impeachment. Trump's references to, quote, the enemy from within, unquote, have become so frequent that former White House press secretary turned political analyst Jen Psaki, P-S-A-K-I, has called them his closing argument for the 2024 election. And she warned that his construction of those who oppose him as, quote, enemies, unquote, might sweep in virtually anyone he feels is a threat. In a searing article today, political scientist Rachel Bitecover, B-I-T-E-C-O-F-E-R of The Cycle, explained exactly what that means in the piece titled, quote, What Really Happens If Trump Wins, unquote. Bitecover outlined Adolf Hitler's January 30th, 1933 oath of office, in which he promised Germans he would uphold the Constitution and the 3 months he took to dismantle that Constitution. By March, she notes, the concentration camp Dachau was open. Its first prisoners were not Jews, but rather Hitler's prominent political opponents. By April, Jews had been purged from the civil service, and the opposition political parties were illegal. By May, labor unions were banned, and students were burning banned books. Within the year, that's 1933, public criticism of Hitler and the Nazis was illegal, and denouncing violators paid well for those who did it. Why don't you continue from there, Monty?
Of course. Bitecover writes that Trump had promised mass deportations, quote, that he cannot deliver unless he violates both the Constitution and the federal law, end quote. To enable that policy, Trump will need to dismantle the merit-based civil service and put into office those loyal to him rather than the Constitution. Then he will purge his political opponents for Once those who would stand against him are purged, Trump can act as he wishes against immigrants, for example, and others. 90 years ago, as American reporter Dorothy Thompson ate her breakfast at her hotel in Berlin on 25 August 1934, a young man from Hitler's secret police, the Gestapo, quote, politely handed me a letter and requested a signed receipt, end quote. She thought nothing of it, she said. Quote, but what a surprise was in store for me, end quote. The letter informed her that, quote, in light of your numerous anti-German publications, she was being expelled from Germany. She was the first American journalist to be expelled from Nazi Germany, and that expulsion was no small thing. Thompson had moved to London in 1920 to become a foreign correspondent and began to spend time in Berlin. In 1924, she moved to the city. In 1924, she moved to the city to head the Central European Bureau for the New York Evening Post and the Philadelphia Public Ledger. From there, she reported on the rise of Adolf Hitler. She left her Berlin post in 1928 to marry novelist Sinclair Lewis, and the two settled in Vermont. When the couple traveled to Sweden in 1930 for Lewis to accept the Nobel Prize in Literature, Thompson visited Germany, where she saw the growing strength of the fascists and the apparent inability of the Nazis' opponents to come together and stand against them. She continued to visit the country in the following years, reporting on the rise of fascism there and elsewhere. In 1931, Thompson interviewed Hitler and declared that rather than, quote, the future dictator of Germany, end quote, she had expected to meet, he was a man of, quote, startling insignificance, end quote. She asked him if he would, quote, abolish the Constitution of the German Republic, end quote. He answered, I will get into power legally, end quote, and once in power, abolish the Parliament and the Constitution, end quote, found an authority state from the lowest cell to the highest instance. Everywhere there will be responsibility and authority above, discipline and obedience below, end quote. She did not believe he could succeed. Imagine a would-be dictator setting out to persuade a sovereign people to vote away their rights, she wrote in an apparent astonishment.
Gee whiz. I mean, imagine that. Let me pick up from there. I mean, whoa. Can't imagine something like that. By the way, Dorothy Thompson is quoted in one of the books available on the flash drive, Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Pettens, published in 1953. And she was interviewed in 1940 by a major New York paper. Might have been the New York Post. But anyway, she spoke with top German industrialists and some Nazi Party officials, and they laughed away the notion of conquering America through an invasion. And they stressed that they already had very profound relations with key economic and financial figures in the U.S., and that it was those connections with those prominent industrialists and financiers that would lead them to take control of America. And she noted that whereas in this country, political power is seen as yielding economic power, in Germany it is otherwise, that economic power yields, automatically yields political power. And Adolf Hitler's most earliest and most prominent financial backers, the Vatican in 1919, when Papal Nuncio to Munich, Germany, Archbishop Eugenio Pacelli, later and better known as Pope Pius XII, was funding Hitler from the Vatican. That was in 1919. Then Henry Ford, the powerful American industrialist. And then George Herbert Walker and his son-in-law, Prescott Bush, the great-grandfather and grandfather, respectively, of the aforementioned George W. Bush, and the grandfather and father, respectively, of the aforementioned George H.W. Bush, were among Hitler's most prominent backers. So those are some of the people Dorothy Thompson was talking about. And resuming again. Thompson was back in Berlin in the summer of 1934 as a representative of the Saturday Evening Post when she received the news that she had 24 hours to leave the country. The other foreign correspondents in Berlin saw her off on the railway station with, quote, grape sheaves of American beauty roses, unquote. Safely in Paris, Thompson mused that in her first years in Germany, she had gotten to know many of the officials of the German Republic, and that when she had left to marry Louis, they offered, quote, many expressions of friendship and gratitude, unquote. But times had changed, quote, I thought of them sadly as my train pulled out, unquote, she said, carrying me away from Berlin. Some of those officials still are in the service of the German government, some of them are émigrés, and some of them are dead, unquote. Thompson came home to a nation where many of the same dark impulses were simmering, her fame after her expulsion from Germany following her. She lectured against fascism across the country in 1935, and then began a radio program that reached tens of millions of listeners. Hired in 1936 to write a regular column 3 days a week for the New York Herald Tribune, she became a leading voice in print, too, warning that what was happening in Germany could also happen in America. Take it from there, Moppy, if you will.
In an echo of Lewis's best-selling 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here, she wrote in a 1937 column, quote, no people ever recognize their dictator in advance. He always represents himself as an instrument for expressing the incorporated national will. When Americans think of dictators, they always think of some foreign model. If anyone turned up here in a fur hat, boots, and a grim look, he would be recognized and shunned. But when our dictator turns up, you can depend on it that he will be one of the boys, and he will stand for everything traditionally American, end quote. In less than 2 years, the circulation of her column had grown to reach between 7 and 8 million people. In 1939, a reporter wrote, quote, she is read, believed, and quoted by millions of women who used to get their political opinions from their husbands, who got them from political commentator Walter Lippmann. The report likened Thompson to First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, saying that they were the two, quote, most influential women in the United States, end quote.
Just interrupting, maybe that's Walter Lippmann, the famous columnist. Continue, Moppy, please.
Mm-hmm. As an editorial note, it should be recognized that Walter Lippmann later was a propagandist for the Central Intelligence Agency. But continuing with the article, when 22,000 American Nazis held a rally at New York City's Madison Square Garden in honor of President George Washington's birthday on 20 February 1939, Thompson sat in the front row of the press box, where she laughed loudly at the speeches and yelled bunk at the stage, illustrating that she would not be muzzled by Nazis. After being escorted out, she returned to her seat, where stormtroopers surrounded her. She later told a reporter, I was, quote, I was amazed to see a duplicate of what I had saw 7 years ago in Germany. Tonight, I listened to words taken out of the mouth of Adolf Hitler, end quote. 2 years later, in 1941, Thompson returned to the issue she raised when she mused about those government officials who had gone from thanking her to expelling her. In a piece for Harper's Magazine titled, quote, Who Goes Nazi, end quote, she wrote, quote, it is an interesting and somewhat macabre parlor game to play at a large gathering of one's acquaintances. To speculate who is in a showdown would go Nazi, end quote. She wrote, quote, by now I think I know. I have gone through the experience many times in Germany, in Austria, and in France. I have come to know the types, the born Nazis, the Nazis whom democracy itself had created, the certain to-be fellow travelers, and I also know those who never, under any conceivable circumstances, would become Nazis, end quote.
Let me take it from there, Moppy. Let me take it from there.
Please.
Examining a number of types of Americans, she wrote that the line between democracy and fascism was not wealth or education or race or age or nationality. Quote, kind, good, happy, gentlemanly, secure people never go Nazi, unquote, she wrote. They were secure enough to be good-natured and open to new ideas, and they believed so completely in the promise of American democracy that they would defend it with their lives even if they seemed too easygoing to join a struggle. Quote, but the frustrated and humiliated intellectual, the rich and scared speculator, the spoiled son, the labor tyrant, the fellow who has achieved success by snowing out the wind of success, they would all go Nazi in a crisis, unquote. She wrote, again quoting, those who haven't anything in them to tell them what they like and what they don't, whether it is reading or happiness or wisdom or a code, however old-fashioned or however modern, go Nazi, unquote. In Paris, following her expulsion from Berlin, Thompson told a reporter for the Associated Press that the reason she had been attacked was the same reason that Hitler's power was growing. Quote, Chancellor Hitler is no longer a man. He is a religion, unquote, she said, suggesting her expulsion was because of her old article disparaging Hitler. In her own article about her expulsion, she wrote, in her own article about her expulsion, she noted, quote, my offense was to think that Hitler is just an ordinary man, after all. That is a crime against the reigning cult in Germany, which says Mr. Hitler is a messiah sent by God to save the German people. By the way, parenthetically, just think about the evangelicals lining up behind Donald Trump. Who is about as far from an evangelical as you're going to get, but it's just wild. Anyway, again, quoting, let me reread this last paragraph. Suggesting her expulsion was because of her old article disparaging Hitler, in her own article about her expulsion, she noted, quote, my offense was to think that Hitler is just an ordinary man, after all. That is a crime against the reigning cult in Germany, which says Mr. Hitler is a messiah sent by God to save the German people. To question this mystic mission is so heinous that, if you are a German, you can be sent to jail. I, fortunately, am an American, so I merely was sent to Paris. Worse things can happen. And then in the written description for this program, we will have Rachel Bitecofer article from The Cycle, What Really Happens If Trump Wins. And perhaps in the interest of time, we'll just leave this one to people who will read the written description for the programs. I will just read this one section here. Quote, and this again from the Rachel Bitecofer article, reference in that by Heather Cox Richardson Post. Quote, Alphonse Heck, H-E-C-K, then a member of the Hitler Youth, recalled the effects of the law. In 1938, he was living, that is, at first they would do so in social settings. Later they would do so in their own homes for fear that their own children, eventually conscripted into either the Hitler Youth or the League for German Girls, might denounce them. This is the law. This is the law against malicious attacks on state and party, which the Nazis set up special courts to prosecute. At first, and the people criticized them, at first they would do so in social settings. Later, they would do so in their own homes for fear that their own children, eventually conscripted into either the Hitler Youth or the League for German Girls, might denounce them. Quote, Alphonse Heck, then a member of the Hitler Youth, recalled the effects of the law. In 1938, he was living with his grandparents when his father came to visit. In retrospect, I think it was the last time my father railed against the regime in front of me. He wasn't much of a drinker, but when he had had a few too many, he had a tendency to shout down everyone else. Not a small feat among the men of my family, unquote. Quote, you mark my words, mother, unquote, he yelled. That goddamn Austrian house painter is going to kill us all before he's through conquering the world, unquote. And then his baleful eye fell on me. Again, quoting, they're going to bury you in this goddamn monkey suit, his Hitler Youth uniform, my boy, unquote. He chuckled, but that was too much for my grandmother. Quote, why don't you leave him alone? Do Zimmer, you stupid fool, she said sharply, and watch your mouth. You want to end up in a concentration camp? He laughed bitterly and added, quote, "So it has come that far already, your own son turning you in," unquote. My grandmother told me to leave the kitchen, but the last thing I heard was my father's sarcastic voice, "Are you people all blind? This thing with the Jews is just beginning." And yes, indeed. So when you think about the bloody removal of 15 or 20 people, including descendants of people, the remigration concept, you better think very carefully about this. And again, I'm just excerpting the Rachel Bitkofer article about...
And if I may, real quick, Dave, back to what Larry Alan Schmidt and... Robert Alan Surrey and Larry Schmidt did in picking Bernard Weissman. I should note their motivations for putting Weissman's name on the Welcome to Dallas leaflet for President Kennedy on the day he was assassinated. The whole motivation for affixing Bernard Weissman's name to that document is because his last name sounded Jewish and they wanted to blame a Jew for the murder of President Kennedy.
Yes, indeed. And again, the flowers that are blooming devastatingly in our land right now are the fruit of seeds that were planted really before the end of World War II, really before World War II, but that really the planting season really gathered steam, so to speak, on November 22nd, 1963. There's another article here from The Scoop, a New Zealand publication, from October 8th of 2019. This is by Wayne Madsen, M-A-B-S-E-N. Now, he is very uneven. Some of his work sucks. Some of it's really good. He does have a background in naval intelligence, probably ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence. So, again, this appears to be one of his better works. And, again, he's done some very good work. He's also laid some real eggs. But with that advisory... thinking about Donald Trump and the fact that Deutsche Bank, by the way, the name of the guy was Val Brooksmith, whose father had committed suicide. He was a top official with a quote, "committed suicide," unquote. And Val Brooksmith was giving documents about Trump's relationship with Deutsche Bank to the FBI. Then he died, either, I've forgotten whether it was suicide or an alleged drug overdose. But anyway.
May I ask Dave what the spelling is on that name?
B-R-O-E-K. S-M-I-T. If you look at Val Brooksmith and his father, both are discussed in, use the search function on the SpitfireList.com website, open quote, Val, V-A-L, Brooksmith, couple B-R-O-E-K-S-M-I-T. In the wake of the financial collapse of 2008, a whole lot of very suspicious deaths of bankers. One guy supposedly committed suicide by shooting himself 7 times with a nail gun. I mean, that's just, hello. But, you know, that, Mort Saul, the brilliant late political comedian and one of Jim Garrison's investigators, noted in his 1976 autobiography, Heartland, how many lies before you belong to the lies? Well, I guess we're all going to find out. This is called The America of Trump's Father by Wayne Madsen. Why don't you begin this one, Monty?
Yes, I'll read it. The America of Trump's Father by Wayne Madsen, Scoop. And this is, once again, October 8, 2019. Quote, on 31 May 1927, Fred Trump was arrested by police while participating in a Ku Klux Klan march in his home borough of Queens, New York. The elder Trump was publicly known to be a racist, and he refused to rent his apartments in Queens and Brooklyn to African Americans. In 1927, there were few organizations for far-right extremists like Fred Trump to join. One was the KKK, which had its roots in the post-Civil War Reconstruction South. Another was Italian leader Benito Mussolini's Overseas Fastisci, which was primarily composed of Italian immigrants to the United States. By the early 1930s, far right wingers in the American North were fast to embrace the Nazis and Kundbund, which was able and ready to answer the call and begin recruiting to its ranks. Fred Trump's FBI file, which includes the 1927 arrest at the Ku Klux Klan March, appears to be missing his pre-war and immediate post-war activities. The file does not resume until the 1960s, when the FBI began monitoring the elder Trump's association with mafia syndicates in New York.
I'm going to interrupt right there. I think his first name was Fritz Kuhn, the head of the German-American Bund. That's B-U-N-D.
That's right.
And, again, this is about the elder Trump. Bear in mind Trump's, not only his blood obsession, as we noted, but, also, some of the interesting things here, continue, Mavi, with your reading of this, article by Wayne Madsen.
As a slight editorial, I should note that Kuhn's partner in South America, see, Fritz Kuhn was the chief of the North American Bund. Kuhn's partner in South America was a man by the name of John Wilson Hudson, who was one of the founding members of the Radio Cuba Libre organization that spawned Brigade 2506, which was the invasion task force for Operation Zapata. So let that sit in a little bit for, you know, who could have motivated the anti-Castro community to be involved in the murder of President Kennedy? Oh, I don't know. Maybe the founder of the German-American Bund in South America, John Wilson Hudson. But continue with the article.
And by the way, Operation Zapata was the Bay of Pigs invasion. And again, we've noted that the Falange, the organization we spoke about in connection with Prince Max Egan von Hohenlohe, the Spanish Civil War, Francisco Franco, Reimers in the book that J.B. Vance has supported, that the epicenter of the Falange, the Hispanic pan-global fascist organization in the Americas, was in Havana, Cuba. And where do you think
That's
they
right.
went when Castro took over? Continuing, Monty.
Right. So, quote, it is known that old man Trump, the appellation given to him by folk singer Woody Guthrie, in a 1950 song of the same title, continued his racist ways after the war. Guthrie, who had talked him in his fortune of renting a unit in the Trump-owned Beach Haven apartments in Brooklyn, penned the following lyric, quote, Beach Haven is Trump's tower, where no black folks come to roam. No, no, old man Trump, old Beach Haven ain't my home, end quote. It is also interesting that after the war, Trump insisted that he was of Swedish descent. In fact, old man Trump's father, Frederick Trump, was an immigrant from Karlstad, Bavaria. It was famed aviator Charles Lindbergh, a Nazi sympathizer who stressed his Swedish descent to defend against charges that he was a supporter of Hitler. However, in both cases, old man Trump and Lindbergh, there was no question of their sympathies to the racial policies of Hitler and the new Germany.
Let me just interrupt there, Mobby. Do note about Fred Trump's FBI file, as noted here by Wayne Madsen, quote, Fred Trump's FBI file, which includes the 1927 arrest at the KKK march, appears to be missing his pre-war and immediate post-war activities. I wonder why that might B. Let me continue at that point. Old man Trump's home and businesses sat in the midst of Bund activities and businesses that supported the Bund. One of the most popular newspapers among the German-American community in New York and New Jersey was the Bund's, quote, The Free American and Deutsche Weckruf, capital W-E-C-K-R-U-F, I'm probably butchering the pronunciation, published from 1935 to 1941 in both English and German. The newspaper served to rally the Nazi cause in New York and New Jersey. The paper advertised New York theaters like the Tobis 86th Casino, 79th Street, and Bijou that screened propaganda films fresh from the studios of Nazi filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl, one of the models, by the way, as I mentioned, of Roger Ailes, the founder of Fox News. Continuing. Nazi Germany's cultural inundation of the U.S. was a personal project of propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels. In 1933, Trump opened the Trump supermarket in Queens at the corner of 78th Street and Jamaica Avenue. Since it was the first store of its type in Queens, it was an immediate success. Considering old man Trump's political viewpoints, It is very likely that he purchased wholesale products, including meats from the Boone butchers and German baked goods from Boone bakers, of which there were several in New York City for his store. Several German-American-owned area businesses, including Meyer's Pork Store and Elmer's Pork Store, both on, quote, Dritte Avenue, D-R-I-T-T-E, Third Avenue in Manhattan, and berries like Karsten's Milch of the Bronx and Astoria in Queens, and Herbs at ERB's German Sweet Shop in Manhattan, kept the advertising-dependent The Free American and Deutsche Weckhoff flush with ad revenue. Again, note that the businesses apparently patronized by a Trump's operation helped to fund the Bund paper. Continuing, even large corporations like Philco, a manufacturer of radios, PepsiCo, Olympia Typewriter, and Simmons Mattress Company advertised in the Nazi newspaper. Nazi propaganda in German was broadcast on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays from the studios of WBNX, first located in the Bronx and then moved to New Jersey. Old Man Trump rented thousands of his apartment units in Jamaica Estates in Queens and Brooklyn to white Americans only. Bund supporters cheered Hitler for refusing to shake the hand of black American Olympian Jesse Owens after he won 4 gold medals in the 1936 Berlin Olympics. Considering Old Man Trump's previous membership of the KKK, he was undoubtedly cheering Hitler's snub of Owens, along with the Bund in New York. Old Man Trump also suspiciously volunteered after dodging in the World War II draft to construct Navy barracks and garden apartments in at least 3 highly sensitive Navy ports in Chester, Pennsylvania, and Norfolk and Newport News, Virginia. All 3 ports saw thousands of American and Canadian troops embark for combat in North Africa and Europe. Some of these troop ships fell prey to German U-boats, which received intelligence on the Allied ship movements from Nazi agents in the very same port areas where Old Man Trump so, quote, generously, unquote, bid on construction contracts with the Navy. Let me read these last few sentences again. Old Man Trump also suspiciously volunteered after dodging the World War II draft to construct Navy barracks and garden apartments in at least 3 highly sensitive Navy ports in Chester, Pennsylvania, and Newfork and Newport News, Virginia, Norfolk and Newport News, Virginia. All 3 ports saw thousands of American and Canadian troops embark for combat in North Africa and Europe. Some of these troop ships fell prey to German U-boats, which received intelligence on the Allied ship movements from Nazi agents in the very same port areas where Old Man Trump so, quote, generously, unquote, bid on construction contracts with the Navy. Obviously, that's not definitive, but it certainly raises some interesting questions. Then the blog, skip me down. Just as
in real, Dave, if I may interrupt, I just want to note, in the same time period on the East Coast, a naval intelligence officer by the name of Harold Keith Thompson was in the United States Navy at the exact same time that he was an Auslan Sinkdereitdienst agent for the Gestapo in their overseas branch. So, you know, the whole idea that, you know, Trump may have been using his facilities to potentially spy on these troop movements is not, once again, there is a historical precedent to that, and that would be Harold Keith Thompson.
Yep, and H. Keith Thompson, as he was generally known, again, an American agent of the Sicherheitsdienst, that is the SS Intelligence Service, and foreign intelligence for that organization was maintained by Walter Schellenberg, whose agent, Prince Max Egan von Hohenlohe, who we've spoken about at great length, was hobnobbing with Alan Dulles in early 1943, an act of treason, one of many, one might even say business as usual for Alan Dulles. And Keith Thompson, by the way, was also handling press activities for Marguerite Oswald, Oswald's mother, in the wake of the JFK assassinations.
He was also a PR man for Fulgencio Bautista and the former king of Romania, who was, of course, the chief of the Iron Guard. So, you know.
Oh, wow. Off the top of your head, can you cite us the sources for that?
Oh, the source for that would be Kevin Coogan's book, Dreamer of the Day, about Francis Parker Yockey.
a brilliant book. And again, I interviewed the late brilliant Kevin Coogan many, many times, and those broadcasts are available on the 64 gigabyte flash drive that's available. Again, everything that I've done is on there. And the Madsen article continues or concludes, just as other Nazis, including Adolf Eichmann in Argentina, tried to assume benevolent post-war profiles, even living among expatriate German Jewish communities, old man Trump became a close friend of Benjamin Netanyahu and other top Israelis and New York Jewish community leaders. And I've noted that the Zionist movement, like so many political movements between the world wars, there was a profound fascist element within it as the Axis powers sought to destabilize the colony-holding rivals like Britain and France, etc. And one of the arguably the most significant was that headed up by Vladimir Jabotinsky. David Ben-Gurion referred to him as Vladimir Hitler and argued strenuously against having Jabotinsky's remains repatriated for burial in Israel. And Vladimir Jabotinsky's personal secretary and a pallbearer at his funeral was Benjamin Netanyahu, the father of and political mentor to Benjamin Netanyahu. And when Israel sends mercenaries, quote, mercenaries, unquote, and military aid to contemporary Ukraine, as they have been doing, it represents something of a fulfillment of a cycle because of Vladimir Jabotinsky, whose Beitar fascists took military training with Mussolini's Naval Cadet School, were reviewed by Il Duce himself, and collected scrap metal for Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia. But one of the many reasons I consider Jabotinsky to be an absolute traitor to everything, you know, the Jews maintained or Zionism, he advocated an alliance with the forces of a prominent Ukrainian fascist and pogromist named Semyon Petliura. The spelling varies, P-E-T-L-I-U-R-A. You also see it P-E-T-L-Y-U-R-A. He was assassinated by an emigre Jew in Paris in the mid-20s, and the judge, and certainly Paris in the mid-20s was not very sympathetic to the position of Jews, but he was acquitted because this man's entire family was butchered by Semyon Petliura's pogromists. And Semyon Petliura, along with Yaroslav Stetsko, along with Stefan Bandera, along with Roman Shukevich, is one of the fascist icons of the contemporary fascist movement in Ukraine, dominated by the Azov formations, about whom we've spoken. So when...
If I may interrupt real quick, Dave.
Absolutely.
It should be noted that Vladimir Jabotinsky's top lieutenant within the Irgun organization, which you know, in English is actually a Hebrew a fiction of the words National Military Organization in the Land of Israel. It was an offshoot of Haganah, okay? It should be noted that Vladimir Jabotinsky's top lieutenant within Irgun, which, you know, was an offshoot of Haganah, was a man by the name of Scheiber. And the full spelling on his name is Hivi Scheiber. It's a capital H-A-V-I-V-S-C-H. Reading again, capital H-A-V-I-V, last name spelled S-C-H-E-I-B-E-R, Hivi Scheiber. And it should be noted, and I know I've mentioned this in a program, I believe it was in our Patreon talks, it should be noted that when Frank Sturges first infiltrated into Cuba in 1956 to join Fidel Castro's operations, where he later became the personal bodyguard for Che Guevara in 1960, it should be noted that when Frank Sturges was sent by the Office of Naval Intelligence and the CIA to infiltrate Fidel Castro's organization, he infiltrated into Cuba under the assumed identity of a or excuse me, under the identity of a UPI reporter, okay, under the identity of a United Press reporter, and the man that actually gave him the false identification to infiltrate into Cuba for the CIA and the ONI was Hyvie Scheiber. Now, how did Hyvie Scheiber pay for this? Well, at the time, Scheiber was a representative of the Anti-Communist Legion of Israel and a personal representative of Yaroslav Stetsko's OUN in Israel. Okay?
Oh, so, man. I mean, I really have to discipline myself because this is for broadcast purposes, and I feel like reaching into the foulest backwaters of my vocabulary to express my feelings about this. What is your source for this, Nobby?
Oh, my source for that is Kevin Coogan's posthumous release, The Spy Who Would Be Czar, Mikhail Golininsky and the Mystery of the Far Right in the United States.
Again, and, that's the Rutledge Press, is it not? R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E?
Correct. And then once again, I'm sorry to say it's a posthumous release, but a million thanks to Kevin Coogan for presenting that information that, you know, the founder of the Israeli branch of the World Anti-Communist League, a personal lieutenant to Jabotinsky and later a personal representative of Yaroslav Stetsko's OUN in Israel. And I should note that this occurred throughout the entirety of the Cold War. Scheiber was actually, by 1976, the commander of the Israeli wing of the World Anti-Communist League under Roger Pearson. So to think that there are not fascists in Israeli intelligence, one does not need to look further than Mr. Hyvie Scheiber and his connections to the World Anti-Communist League, the OUN, and literally funding Frank Sturgis's covert activities in Cuba throughout the late 50s and early 60s.
Wow. And once again, a huge tip of the hat to the now residing in heaven to the late brilliant Kevin Coogan, author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, and also of The Spy Who Would Be Czar, Mikhail Golininsky, that you just accessed. And again, two other former prime ministers of Israel, Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, were also veterans of the Irgun and the Beit Har, and also the Stern Gang as well. We should also note that one of the things, again, I've mentioned this in the past that I find very disturbing is the complete erasure of historical memory. And there was a very powerful element within the early Zionist movement and Israel that was, they were doctrinaire socialists. And many of them were military veterans of the brutal partisan warfare in Eastern Europe. And they were doctrinaire socialists. And they saw the fledgling state of Israel as a socialist state in which both Arabs and Jews could live side by side. Nassim,
real quick, Dave, it should be noted, just again for a historical preface, precedence on this, and what is representational of the violent right-wing reactionaries that existed within Israeli intelligence, literally from its inception, like Hyvie Scheiber, it should be noted that the most powerful communist party in the Middle East from 1931 to 1939 was the Palestinian Communist Party. Okay? So consider that in terms of historical precedence and what the Palestinians have been going through for, you know, 90 plus years.
And also, again, as I said, this was a very significant element in the Zionist movement and in early Israel. And they saw Arabs and Jews living side by side in their socialist Zionist paradise. And I've seen the watercolor paintings of the Zionist Jews in their mobless fatigues and the smiling Arabs in their kafirs. I'm probably mispronouncing that. And this has been completely erased. And I would note that the Likud party sent a representative, Udi Cohen, to the National Congress of the Alleanza Nazionale of Gianfranco Fini, the Italian fascist party in the late 1990s. What happened in Israel is what has happened in so much of the Western-dominated or oriented countries. Ultimately, the fascists were elevated to power. And in the description for the record programs 1316 and 1317, I have the text of a letter written by Albert Einstein and Hannah Arendt of others to the New York Times in, I think it was 1948, maybe 49, warning about Menachem Begin and his fascists in Israel. And they not only attacked Arabs, but they also attacked and murdered any Jews who opposed them, Jews who wanted to organize labor unions or anything else. The point being that Israeli fascism, which in Israel is dominated by fascism at this point in time, it is the outgrowth of powerful forces that had a gathering storm, the clouds of which were coalescing on the horizon in the 1930s. And this is all, again, a matter of record, but they, once again, a huge tip of the hat, not only to you, Monty, but also to the late, brilliant Kevin Coogan, and all of my many interviews with him, plus long text excerpts from Dreamer of the Day, are available on the 64-gigabyte flash drive that is available. Now, one of the interesting things about the situation we're in, and as we hear about Trump, gaining popularity and all the people who are aligning with Trump, who should probably know better, this article from Politico from May 5th of 2020 might give us some interesting insights. It's called, it's by Quint Forget, Q-U-I-N-T, last name F-O-R-G-E-Y. And this, the article is excerpted at length in the written description for this program and others that I've spoken about in connection with COVID, excerpting this. A new academic paper produced by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York concludes that deaths caused by the 1918 influenza pandemic, quote, profoundly shaped German society, unquote, in subsequent years and contributed to the strengthening of the Nazi Party. Quote, the paper published this month and authored by New York Fed economist Christian, capital K-R-I-S-T-I-A-N, Blickle, capital B-L-I-C-K-L-E, examined municipal spending levels and voter extremism in Germany from the time of the initial influenza outbreak until 1933, and shows that, quote, areas which experience a greater relative population decline, unquote, due to the pandemic spent, quote, less per capita on their inhabitants in the following decade, unquote. Again, quoting, the paper's findings are likely due to, quote, changes in societal preferences, unquote, following the 1918 outbreak, Blickle argues, suggesting the influenza pandemic's disproportionate pull on young people may have, quote, spurred resentment of foreigners among the survivors, unquote, and driven voters to parties, quote, whose platform matched such sentiments. One more time. The paper's findings are likely due to, quote, changes in societal preferences, unquote, following the 1918 outbreak, Blickle argues, suggesting the influenza pandemic's disproportionate toll on young people may have, quote, spurred resentment of foreigners among the survivors and driven voters to parties, quote, whose platform matched such sentiments, unquote. The conclusions came amid fears that the current coronavirus pandemic will shake up international politics and spur extremism around the world as officials and public health experts look to previous outbreaks for guidance on how to navigate the months and years to come. And we've only got about 12 minutes left here. I'm going to do my best to encapsulate, and I apologize, Marty, because I'm going to try and run the ball through and into the end zone here before the timer runs out. But I've done massive amounts of work on the pandemic.
Right.
And a paralegal could get a conviction in this case. some of the key articles, there was a brilliant article by Jeffrey Sachs. This is in the PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, quote, a call for an independent inquiry into the origin of the SARS-CoV-2 virus by Neil L. Harrison and Jeffrey B. Sachs. And among the things it notes, I want to note something. The whole notion of the lab leak hypothesis is like positing a strategic arms limitation treaty between the U.S. and Russia in which they both agreed to limit their production of crossbows. I mean, it's completely obsolete technologically. From an article from the Guardian magazine of June 19th of 2018 by Ian Sample, S-A-M-P-L-E, talking about synthetic biology. Advances in the area mean that scientists now have the capability to recreate dangerous viruses from scratch, make harmful bacteria more deadly, and modify common microbes so that they churn out lethal toxins once they enter the body. In the report, the scientists describe how synthetic biology, which gives researchers precision tools to manipulate living organisms, enhances and expands, unquote, opportunities to create bioweapons. Today, the genetic code of almost any mammalian virus can be found online and synthesized. Quote, the technology to do this is available now, unquote, said Michael Imperiali. Quote, it requires some expertise, but it's something that's relatively easy to do, and that is why it tops the list. Now, the company that was synthesizing these viruses at Wuhan, and of course the findings were published with the genomes, and they were put into the database of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which I have labeled the Oswald Institute of Virology in a long series I've done. The organization is called the EcoHealth Alliance. Its primary funding sources are the Pentagon and the Agency for International Development, a State Department subsidiary that is a major focal point for covert operations. The guy who headed that up is a guy named Peter Daszak. His father was named Bohdan Daszak. He is from Ukraine. I said, I wonder what he may have done in World War II. Because he was 19 in March of 1945. That's just the right age. And there was an article badly skewed but called Gifted Lies. And again, this is in the description for this show. And it's in other shows as well, programmed the For the Record program 1302. Bohdan Daszak was recruited to work in a Nazi concentration camp. And it says that he basically was 16 in 1944. No, he was 18 in 1944. Ukraine wasn't a country, unquote. At that point in time, it was a republic of the former USSR, the Soviet Union. And the country wasn't, quote, invaded, unquote, in 1944. It was invaded in 1941. And very quickly, Monty, and we're down the last few minutes of the show, in really encapsulated fashion, I would also note that Peter Daszak's family, as noted from his own social media posts, are from the Lvov area in western Ukraine. That is an epicenter of the OUNB. Tell us about the Yanoska camp that was just outside of Lvov. Very quickly, Monty.
Well, it was the acts at the Yanoska camp were so heinous that even the Nazi SS guards that helped administer the camp put in complaints to the Reich's main security command at the absolute brutality that was taking place there. I mean, people were literally being pulled apart, flayed alive, mass beheadings of men, women, and children. I mean, it was just an absolute nightmare, a hell on earth.
And that apparently is where Bohdan Daszak worked, because again, the Nazis would not have sent him to another concentration camp that was in a different part of Ukraine. So in all probability, he was at Yanoska. And that raises the very interesting question as to whether Peter Daszak might be, and again, I note, might be a second generation Nazi war criminal, what I call food for thought and grounds for further research. Now, in this aforementioned Neil Harrison and Jeffrey Sachs article, and Jeffrey Sachs was appointed by the British Lancet publication, a prestigious medical journal out of the UK, to head up their inquiry into the origins of COVID. And in a now-deleted Twitter video, he opined that it came from a U.S. biolab, not an accident of nature. But also in this paper, He notes, the gaming of the Lancets, a statement on the origin of coronavirus being, quote, natural, unquote. And it was Peter Daszak working with Ralph Barrich from the University of North Carolina that deliberately gamed the article of the statement in the direction of a natural origin. The concept, the legal concept of consciousness of guilt figures in prominently in a Vanity Fair article by Janet Aben from 2021 about the origins of COVID. Trump, national security officials, when they were talking about the origins of COVID, they discouraged looking into that because they said, unquote, it would open a, quote, can of worms, unquote, or a, quote, Pandora's box because it would shed light on U.S. funding of the projects. Now, the EcoHealth Alliance was partnered with a company called Metabiota, another apparent BW front.
Jesus.
That Hunter Biden in his laptop, and this comes from the Daily Mail, a right-wing paper in the U.K., not only were there was Metabiota involved with the labs in Ukraine, but it also was partnered with EcoHealth Alliance, and again, at the same time as they were synthesizing novel coronaviruses, and with venture capital from Imputel, the CIA's venture capital arm, they were partnered with Munich Reinsurance, a German company that was an ally of the Third Reich, a vehicle for the Third Reich and the Bormann Group. And in 2018, their business perspective, they were selling pandemic insurance, and their target institutions were presented with a prospectus that they needed to protect themselves because, and it, again, they're talking 2018, what would happen if a novel coronavirus spread all over the world necessitating quarantining, social distancing, and school closures? This is 2018. Obviously, that's just what happened. And note that Metabiota was partnered with EcoHealth Alliance of Peter Daszak. And also noting in that regard, a conservative group filed a lawsuit with the National Institute of Health and when about the origins of COVID. When the documents they requested were finally released, 290 pages of the documents were redacted by the NIH. Why are they redacting them? And Lawrence Tabak, the acting head of the National Institute of Health, testified before Congress that several such genome sequences in the U.S. database were being removed from public view. Why? Again, the legal concept of consciousness of guilt. And what we're going to play now at the conclusion, this is the now-deleted Twitter, or now X, video of Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who headed up the Lancet Commission.
I'll add one provocative statement. We could take it up later. It may shock you or not shock you, or you may say, I already know that, Professor Sachs. But I chaired a commission for the Lancet for 2 years on COVID. I'm pretty convinced it came out of U.S. lab biotechnology, not out of nature. Just to mention, after 2 years of intensive work on this. So it's a blunder, in my view, of biotech, not an accident of a natural spillover. We don't know for sure, I should be absolutely clear. But there's enough evidence that it should be looked into, and it's not being investigated, not in the United States, not anywhere. And I think for real reasons that they don't want to look underneath the rug control.
And that is all we have time for in this program. I want to apologize, Monty, for dominating things, but I wanted to telescope
this.
No, not at all. And all of this, by the way, is available on the 64-gigabyte flash drive in gruesome detail. Please get that. I get no money from this. All of my conversations with Monty are available on that. This concludes For the Record program number 1356. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 30. This is being recorded on October 26th of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying, trick or treat.